Blog Talk Radio.
Wrestling. On behalf of WTBS, it's a pleasure to welcome the World Wrestling Federation. Exciting new matches, great competitors from all over the world. And here's the man to tell you all about it. Here's Vince McMahon. Vince?
Thank you very much, Freddie.
Welcome aboard.
Thank you. It is indeed a pleasure to be associated with WTBS, and we promise to bring you the greatest in professional wrestling entertainment in the world today.
And, of course, with that, 25 years ago tonight, at about 3 hours ago, So ended some 30 years of locally televised wrestling on a weekly basis, uninterrupted weekly basis, I might add. And here to talk with us tonight about it, of course, Les Thatcher, myself, the host. And, of course, if you are tuning in, normally we are on Wednesdays, but we figured let's do Tuesday night and mark it right. But in with us tonight as well is Dave Meltzer. Dave, how you doing?
Doing pretty good. That was an amazing clip. I haven't heard that in 25 years. Wow.
How you doing, David?
I'm doing great, Les.
Good, good. Glad to hear it. I want to tell you guys, you're both sports fans. Tune it up, the American League, two out, and top of the first.
All right. Well, never mind. I won't go there with the Obama thing. So 25 years ago, I was just talking to Dave right before we went to air, and I didn't let him finish his answer, but first thing I wanted to ask, a couple of things on message boards today, just basically wondering why the event is so romanticized, and I offered what I believe was a pretty good response on the Wrestling Classics message board, and I believe it kind of hit a few people to kind of realize what it was, what it really meant. But I wanted to ask Dave, Georgia fans, are we just homers in this situation? And maybe making this event 25 years ago more important than it maybe was?
Well, there's two ways of looking at it. I mean, I was kind of aware of what was going on, you know, in the weeks leading to that, and it wasn't like the shock to me that it was to almost everyone else. But believe me, even where I lived, it was absolutely shocking when, you know, you got to remember World Championship Wrestling at that point in much of the country had was on cable, so it was a national show at that point. For you guys, I mean, it was bigger for you guys because that was your, you know, weekly live wrestling events were coming to the different cities in Georgia, and it was more of a tradition in the sense that Georgia Championship Wrestling had been on TV in your market since, you know, 20 years, whatever it had been, on TBS since the 70s, but it was on, you know, whatever the other station was that I can't recall off the top of my head, long before that. So for you it was bigger, but it was still, you know, it was still the national wrestling show. I mean, it was equivalent. It was every bit as equivalent if we turned on Raw, you know, tomorrow night, and we saw Dana White come out there and go, "Hey, you motherfuckers, I just bought the company." I mean, and people are going to say that, oh, it wasn't like that. Actually, it was exactly like that.
Well put, David, well put. You know what? I think part of the big shock in terms whether it was the homers or like you're saying, you know, it was a national thing, 82 and 83, you know, I was running the tours here in Ohio, Michigan, and West Virginia. So, I mean, it wasn't regional wrestling at all. It was a national concern. And, of course, WWF at the time was not. And I think the big, you know, the big contrast was Georgia Championship Wrestling / WCW was a more serious entity. And then it looked like then all of a sudden the circus has come to town, you know, fire eaters, clowns, and so on and so on. I think that, you know, and I said to Rich last week before we signed off, I said, you know, also foreshadowed something coming in the future because, you know, basically we've gone full circle and we're right back to that same point again.
Well, you know, the thing is that even though wrestling continued with Ole Anderson running, without that time slot, you know, you didn't get the level of stars and you didn't get the level of attendance. And even though Crockett came back and ran Georgia and, you know, and at times did very well in certain cities, the week, like I said, the weekly regional wrestling, while it didn't die that week, that was what led to the death of it.
Absolutely.
I mean, the tradition, you know, you're talking about, like, yeah, in your area, in Georgia, I mean, I don't think that you could emphasize how big this was, because this wasn't like, you know, where I grew up here in San Francisco, our wrestling died of natural causes or, you know, bad promotion or whatever it would be. Yours died because Vince McMahon bought it, you know, and then that was it. And I mean, I guess the nature of evolution was that it would probably have happened and things would have happened in a different way. And we probably, in the long run, would be exactly where we are today. But it was still, at that time, you know, monumental. And also, it was huge because at that point in 84, Vince was not – he was established on the West Coast and he was established in the Northeast as the big thing. And he was getting established in the Midwest – and some other places because he had Hogan. But the national wrestling time slot was, you know, 6:05 Saturday night, and somebody else had it, and he bought it. And even though his ratings weren't good, you know, as compared to the previous group, you know, he still had that time slot for a year, and nobody else during that year would have, and Vince did a marvelous job of promoting pro wrestling in 84 and 85 when nobody else had national television. So in 85, when Crockett got the show, he had to play catch up, and he never could catch up on it, is really how I would term, you know, how this thing went down.
Right. Hey, Les, with you being in the business at that time, just, I believe you were in the Carolinas, right?
Well, actually I was up in K-Town. I was in Knoxville.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Just kind of give me an idea. I mean, how did word spread among the guys? I mean, obviously you guys are, you know, everybody's pretty much working on Saturday night. Nobody's able to see GCW on TV for the most part. How did word get around the business?
Well, it just, there's an old joke about telephone or tele-wrestler.
Right.
And it was just, you know, it hit the grapevine, and that's the way it went around. But, you know, at the time, a lot of the guys didn't think that it was going to stick, right?
Right.
Because you got to realize what New York was built on for a lot of years, and a lot of people looked at Vince Jr. As the kid, you know, and he was kicking up his heels, he was flexing his muscles, but hey, you know, the business is what it is, and of course that's what gave him the foothold to move on and really take over the world, as it were, simply because nobody believed he was going to be able to do it anyway, you know. And of course, in the southeastern United States, you know, the business was always a much more solid bit of performance, you know, with the exception of Memphis, probably, you know, which was a lot more showbiz type thing, but you know, the rest of the territories in the Southeast were built on solid wrestling, and you know, very little characterization or you know, any type of real out and out showmanship, and so nobody expected him really to, you know, to be able to hang on at that, and you know, but it was shocking in a way, but you know, I've been thinking all week since I knew we were going to do this, and I guess, you know. You mentioned being a homer, and I'm sure it was far more shocking to the fans and the serious fans, you know, actually that, you know, lived and breathed off of Georgia Championship Wrestling for so many years than it was for a lot of us in the business. And, you know, and I kept thinking, you know, how, you know, monumental was this to me? And I guess after being in the business for, at that point, 24 years, it's like there wasn't a lot that surprised me, you know. You've seen a lot of things happen, but I think, you know, I didn't know that it would stick either. It was because realized, and I think Dave would agree with me here, it was a huge experiment, you know. You were putting on, I mean, because at that time, with all the regional promotions, everybody had their own little niche. You know, a lot of it was built on who the booker happened to be or the style. But I know as a worker, when, you know, you go into a territory for the first time, you had to, shift gears sometimes and change your style. And as, you know, I was predominantly a babyface. A lot of times, some areas babyfaces wrestled their comeback. Other areas you made a comeback like you were the heel too. So, you know, a lot of people didn't think that that Northeastern style would stick in the area anyway.
You know, one thing, Dave, you mentioned earlier, I mean, you knew this was coming. Obviously, I believe it was in March of 84, actually 4 months prior, Ole Anderson's mom died. He goes home to Minnesota to deal with family issues there, and, of course, he gets a call from Louise Bennett, who's now, of course, Louise Cochran, that basically they'd taken the company, of course, meaning McMahon. How far in advance had the Briscoes, I guess, started maybe, I don't know, I guess you could call it negotiating with McMahon, but hey, what was the earliest that you know about?
I don't think it was that far in advance. I mean, the person probably, I had no knowledge, nor did anyone, that something was going down until after it had actually happened and the deal was done. And even though it was no news, I mean, there were people in wrestling, you know, who basically, you know, we had found out from people who worked in WWE, WWF at the time, that, you know, we got the deal, and you know they thought they were going on right away, probably you know in March, and then there were some court cases and things like that that delayed it a couple of months.
Right.
So we knew it was probably happening. We knew of the court cases. As far as the negotiations, I mean, I didn't know anything until after the deal was closed. But my remembrance of this from talking to Jack Briscoe was it was put together really quick because his feeling was it's like, you know, they got everyone together and they put that deal together like in a weekend, because his feeling was that if it took any longer than that, the word would get out, and if the word got out, it would never happen.
Right. Yeah, I've read, I went back and reread the piece in Ole Anderson's book about, I guess, that point in time, and he was talking about, you know, the certain articles in the contract and the bylaws, and the one thing that he kept telling the lawyers he was concerned about was basically the one thing that comes back and bites him in the butt. You know, do you remember that passage?
I mean, I know the story from reading the book, and it's amazing to me, especially in that era, you know, that you would be running a company as Ole Anderson was running it, and they could sell it out from under you without. And he was a partial owner, I believe.
Right. And
they didn't have to tell him because they had 51% of the people or more, whatever it was, with you know the Jim Oates shares and the Briscoe shares and whoever else they got on their side. All together, and they went there. And the other, you know, so let's say they got, I don't remember what the percentage was altogether, but I think they had like, you know, maybe six, you know, whatever the percentage was of ownership that they got. Let's say it was 58%, okay?
Right.
I'm throwing out a number because I honestly don't remember.
Right.
That other 40% was completely unaware this was happening to, you know, their own company until the deal was done and then they were told. And it's amazing that a company could have been sold like that. And, you know, again, you know, the idea that it was in the bylaws that it could happen, he recognized it ahead of time, and then the lawyers told him, don't worry, you know, that'll never hold up. Well, it did hold up.
Exactly. And of course, as he states, I believe it was him and Gene still on points, and let's see, Ralph Freed and Fred Ward. And
Did Watts still own points? I think Watts might have owned some points, too.
Well, in his book, he says that Watts had already sold his, I believe, to Ole at that time.
Okay, so that could be right.
Yeah, and Ole says he had 10 points. So, you know, I don't know how much Gene would have had, maybe about even, because I know when they first came into the company, Gene was actually supposed to be the booker. Ole actually ended up with the position. But so I would imagine they came in pretty even. And then, of course, you got Fred. I think Fred had... Well, wait a minute, no, because Fred had, I believe, 25 or 30 points by that time, so maybe not even, but, you know, Ole says he has 10. Either way, it was under 50, and they had convinced, they couldn't convince Paul Jones to sell because Paul wasn't even in his right mind. All the stories I've ever heard is they went to his wife, Frances, and she was more than happy to sell out because she didn't want anything to do with wrestling to begin with. So.
Yeah, that's how I heard it, too.
Well, you know, with Fred, Ralph, his son-in-law, Ralph, basically was the front man for Fred. Fred seldom, I don't think Fred ever, well, I couldn't say never left Columbus, but I know, and being a road agent, I dealt with Ralph, you know, well, I dealt with Ralph more when I was down there, when Gordon and I were doing the TV back in, the, you know, the war of the 70s. You dealt a lot more with Ralph than you did with Fred then, or more, you know, Fred was more involved then, but then when I was running the tours in 82 and 83, Ralph was up here and had, you know, was in immersed physically in a lot more decision-making and involved physically than Fred ever was. So he was, I mean, I don't say, I'm not saying that Ralph, you know, made the decisions for Fred, but he was the front guy. He was the guy that they were, you know, he was the middle man anyway between Fred and whatever was going on with the rest of the partners.
Right. And of course, you know, the interesting thing is Barnett by this time had been basically employed by WWE. So, you know, he knew the ins and outs of that contract. He had to have. You know, so he could work that to his benefit. And of course, you know, he's in Vince's ear. So, you know, basically Vince is up there. He's seeing that, you know, GCW is the only other competition, at least on TV. And of course, they're running shows practically in the backyard of the WWF at the time. So I would imagine, you know, I know you've talked to Vince before. I don't know if you've ever talked to him about this, you know, this situation. But I mean, I would imagine that he was, you know, that time slot was all he was interested in. He didn't care anything about the company, obviously. And by the time he gets it, he is the only game in town, at least on TV.
On a national basis,
right?
He at that point became the only game in town at a time when, partially because of Vince, but also, you know, I mean, wrestling was real popular in a lot of parts of the country at that time, and Vince was one of the reasons, but he was not the only reason, because a lot of the regionals, you know, I mean, let's face it, Dallas was, you know, on fire at that point.
Right.
Mid-South was on, you know, a year from having its best year, you know, in the you know, they were on fire. Actually, I think that was their best year, 84. Crockett was strong and about to get stronger. So a lot of the regionals were doing great, but Vince was doing great as well. You know, he had the Mula Richter thing, which came, I think it was right around the exact same time. You know, the big MTV thing. So Vince had gotten a lot of attention on wrestling, and then at that point, he managed to keep everyone, you know, by getting that time slot, everyone else was off. So if you heard about wrestling, or you were a media type that did anything about wrestling, all you would see if you were researching was Vince on this Vince on this station, he was on, you know, USA, he was on TBS, and then he was on, you know, local syndication in almost every market, and you would figure that Vince was the only wrestling in town, and that's how most of these media stories went. And the media, you know, the media built Vince up as this guy who created pro wrestling, and
that still stands today.
Yeah, it still stands. But the thing is that, you know, I mean, I remember from media stories at that time when they would talk to me, and, you know, and again, I mean, Vince was doing well, and others were doing well, and when you would mention others were doing well, it was almost like, well, they don't count. They're not on TV here, you know, unless you were in Dallas, Texas, or Charlotte, North Carolina, you know, some, you know. But I mean, if you were, you know, most of the media stuff emanated from New York and Los Angeles, and that was all those people could see was Vince's stuff for the most part, and so he had a huge media head start, and I think that was a big, big part of the fact that, you know, Crockett did well for a while. I mean, there were a lot of problems, and he ended up losing the fight. But part of the thing, even at his best, he was playing catch-up everywhere to Vince. I mean, Vince came out to California first. Then Crockett came, but Vince's guys were established, and they had the established time slot. Crockett would have to get on TV in an unfamiliar time slot, establish guys in this market. And, you know, it was one of those things where, you know, he did okay, but he, in most of the country, certainly west of the Mississippi River, Vince was the king.
Did you ever feel like, I mean, obviously before this, you know, with GCW starting to move up into the northern areas, did you ever feel like GCW was about to do what Vince ultimately did?
Well, you know, for me, here's the funny thing. You know, we at this point in time, or a couple of years earlier, early 80s, you know, we were now an AWA promotion because Roy Shires had shut down and Vern had come in.
Mm-hmm.
So we were getting shows once a month, and Vern brought in Tommy Rich. And the house, we were getting 3,000 to 4,500. Tommy Rich came in. We drew 6,000 people. He was over twice as much, you know, maybe time and a half as much as Hogan, who was the big AWA star. So when we saw that, it was like, geez, you know. And that wasn't Dusty. That was Tommy Rich, you know. And I thought Dusty was actually the bigger star of the two at the time.
Right.
So it was like, geez, if they came in, they would beat AWA right off the bat. But and I think that they would have. At the time, they were a more exciting product. AWA was a great product for Minneapolis because of its history, but it was slower, older guys, and Georgia was younger, quicker guys, and Dusty was, you know, really, you know, you can't say enough about Dusty and Ole Anderson and those guys as far as being, you know, great babyface, great heel, and things like that. I think that stuff could have gone in a lot of places and done real well. And I know Briscoe told me that, you know, he thought it could. But Barnett, you know, Barnett, when he was running it, you know, his big thing was that you know, he didn't want to get everyone mad because he came from that old school from the 50s with all those guys who were all, you know, kind of like, you know, the gentleman's agreement is that, you know, Vern's my friend. I don't go to San Francisco. I'll send him talent if he asks for it.
Right.
And,
you know,
and so that was the mentality. And, you know, Vince violated it. And, you know, inevitably, you know, I mean, when I saw Tommy Rich get that pop that night, I mean, I immediately knew that wrestling is changing because this was a guy who had never been here before, who was never on AWA television at all, did not one interview building up the show, and walked in and was more popular than our most popular guy. And that told me right there that this world has changed.
I'll tell you something. You're talking about the gentleman's agreement thing. In 83 up here, I'm the one that opened the door in Cleveland and, you know, sat down with the building and worked out the nuts and bolts of the thing. And, you know, we got our first, I forget what channel it was, but anyway, on the UHF station in Cleveland. And I remember up here on the tour at one point, Barnett calling me at the hotel and asking me, saying, you know, Junior, meaning Vince, is making some waves. And he said, Leslie, you're, you know, being from Ohio, do you ever remember WWF being in Cleveland? And I said, honestly, I don't, because, you know, other than the Sheik going in there a little bit and, you know, some other smaller promotions, it had always been Pedro Martinez in my lifetime out of Buffalo. And so anyway, he was saying that Vince was a little upset that we were in Cleveland. And he said, you know, I may send you a tape, a demo tape, while you're out there on the tour and get you to go. I forget which one of the cities on the Ohio-Pennsylvania border talking about me going in trying to get the Georgia tape on, you know, in the competition with Vince. It never materialized. But so there was a little bit of friction there at that point, and I still to this day don't know why Vince thought that Cleveland belonged to him, because, like I say, in my lifetime, you know, the biggest pop that had ever been in Cleveland was the Buffalo promotion, Pedro Martinez. But anyway, that was – so there was a little, you know, this was in 83, a little friction there because of us being in Cleveland.
Well, there must have been here, too, because Vince came to San Jose in 83, and Vern was in San Francisco. And, you know, it's essentially the same market. So it was, you know, it was Vince coming, you know, Vince, when he ran Los Angeles, you know, Vern was not running Los Angeles, and those were hundreds of miles away. But when he came and ran a ballpark show in San Jose, you know, and this was Bob Backlund and I think Don Morocco, and this is before 84 when all hell broke loose. I mean, when that happened, it was like, you know, there were a lot of things where you could see it coming, and honestly, I just remember in 83, at the end of 83, right before Hogan jumped, we pretty much knew that this was all going to happen, and a lot of the promoters were, you know, almost in denial. Well, he's not really doing this. And it's like, well, he already did it here. And I mean, and there's nothing against the law. I mean, I'm not knocking him for doing it. It was a great decision. I'm just saying that there were a lot of promoters that still thought he really wasn't going to do it, and it was like, he's doing it. I mean, he's doing it, and, you know, you're going to get ready. And I know in the first year and a half they did it, you know, they kind of laid back and said, you know, I mean, there was some point where they worked together, but it was kind of like laying back going, he's going to run out of money because he's spending too much. And it could have happened that way if WrestleMania 1 wasn't successful, but it wasn't. And really, to me, I remember the WrestleMania 1, which was, you know, it was actually right after WrestleMania 1 when they gave up the time slot to Crockett, but they promoted WrestleMania 1 off of TBS.
Right.
You know, that was the make or break. If that thing would have failed, things would have been different. But when that succeeded, I remember the going to WrestleMania 1 in closed circuit, in my head, it was like, okay, it's changed. I mean, it really has, and he's won. I remember Ernie Ladd said he's won the war. And, I mean, afterwards, you know, there were promoters telling me, like, oh, he didn't really win the war because in my city, you know, WrestleMania bombed. And in some cities it did bomb, but there were enough that it didn't. And, you know, eventually in those cities, he kept coming back and he kept coming back, and eventually, you know, they got weak and they got weak, and Vince won.
Yeah, he kept – that's one thing. You're right, Dave. Well, that's like in the Southeast. I know in some of the – well, Birmingham, for one, I know for a fact, because still being in touch with Ron Fuller, you know, out of Mobile. And I know there were times that they ran virtually heads up, and Fuller outdrew WWF, you know, in the market.
A lot of guys did. I remember Watts would go head to head with them and beat them 4-1.
Yeah.
But the point was that you know, it was a victory on that night, but in the long term, it wasn't a victory.
Right. Right.
Now, Dave, you've kind of been a numbers guy, and I know you always, every time I read something with your stuff, you always kind of say anything before 1982 maybe is at least as far as attendance figure should be taken with a grain of salt. But I just wanted to ask you, your take on the business today against the business of, say, 25, 30 years ago, more fans today or more fans then?
More fans then. I mean, that's the one thing which I think that the one thing the newer fans, it's an amazing thing when it comes to Vince. Because I do believe that Vince McMahon is the greatest wrestling promoter I've ever seen. I think he's a borderline genius in some way, in some aspects an absolute genius. But and he's made millions and hundreds of millions of dollars at this business. He's built it bigger as a total business than it's ever been before. However, wrestling was significantly more popular before he was around.
Yes.
And The television ratings, if you go market by market, they're not even close. The live attendance, not even close. I mean, it's like, yeah, he can come here and, you know, twice a year, can come here and draw, 10,000-12,000 people. Well, guess what? I mean, we had a local promotion, that was averaging 9,000-10,000 coming every 3 weeks and running every little city every single night, in this area as opposed to two times in the market and no little cities. And there were way more wrestling fans then, and they were much more fervent fans than they are now. I mean, when I see the reactions at the shows, and it's not that they believe now they don't believe, but there's an emotional involvement from people who go to shows week in and week out, and this is their thing, as opposed to people who go to see the Harlem Globetrotters once a year. And, enjoy it, and it's a fun night out and all that, but there's no emotional involvement now. I mean, I can't wait to go back next week and see, the Globetrotters whip those guys again. It's like, you see it, you'll go see it next year. And that's what WWE is right now. The older wrestling, I mean, I think it was a tougher business in some ways, in the sense that they had to draw week in and week out. But, there are places where wrestling was dead, where WWE and current wrestling is more popular. But I think that there were more places that wrestling was more popular before Vince. So
let me ask you a question. I don't remember the numbers, but I just here the last few days, I was hearing numbers on this past WrestleMania. And would you say, 30-35% of what they drew was outside the United States? In terms of buy rate?
Probably 40. 35 to 40. 40. 35
yeah.
to 40%.
Which, Rich, is my point is to tell you how the business has slipped in this area, in the United States over the last number of years. But like Dave's saying, they're still making a lot of money. But real quick, and I will get back to the subject, I think part of why Brock Lesnar's promo on Saturday night was taken in such a negative context is that our business is taken in such negative context now, much more so. Had this been the Attitude Era, I don't think it would have been such a furor. Do you, Dave?
There's a lot of things with that. I mean, the Lesnar thing came because he was a pro wrestler.
You know,
I mean, it was a unique set of circumstances that nobody could plan or predict, kind of like Steve Austin getting over in a lot of ways. I mean,
right.
It happened, but, anyone who gives Vince McMahon credit for Steve Austin obviously wasn't around when it was happening, because Vince McMahon saw him as a mid-card guy with boots and tights who he couldn't market, and the guy happened to cut a promo that got over, and there were a bunch of signs the next day, and then it just happened, And Lesnar, realistically, it just happened. What he came in, wanting to be an MMA guy, and the MMA fans, and it's because of the negative image of WWE, but not the negative image of pro wrestlers or pro wrestling. It's a really weird dynamic, because I have been to, every major or just almost every major UFC show the last couple of years, and the two most popular celebrities, I've seen, from Tyson to Michael Jordan to, Academy Award winners and TV stars and all this shown on that screen, the two most popular entertainers, celebrities at ringside at a UFC event, number one by far was Steve Austin, and number two, and a distant number two, was Dwayne Johnson, who were both pro wrestlers. And they were not booed. However, in Columbus, when they showed Dave Bautista on the screen, he was booed out of the building. So I sense that it is a thing of people who were fans of pro wrestling, thought pro wrestling was cool, lost interest in pro wrestling. This kind of became their pro wrestling in some cases. And obviously there are people who are UFC fans that were never pro wrestling fans too. But Lesnar represents this pro wrestling. And I think that that was a real negative. He walked in, he was the outsider. It was great the first time he fought Mir last year. And this time it was even bigger because he had beaten Randy Couture. And I mean, it was one of those things where it's such an amazing thing, because what led to it was these guys knew, it was their freaking religion, that jiu-jitsu is going to beat a fake pro wrestler every single time. And it would most times. But,
right.
Also, the idea that this big, jiu-jitsu is made to beat these 290-pound guys. Well, you get some guy like him who's a unique athlete who trained his ass off at this sport. He didn't walk in there blind, because if he walked in there blind, he would have been beaten in a minute. He didn't. He was an incredible athlete. He's trained 2.5 years for it. I give him all the credit in the world. He was very gifted, very lucky that God gave him these gifts. You can say steroids all you want, and Les knows what I mean by this. It's like you can put a million guys on steroids, and at the end of the day, first of all, besides the fact Brock Lesnar wasn't on steroids for this match, I'm almost certain, but the point is that some people are just gifted more than others. And he
right.
is a... I mean, that kind of speed and that kind of strength and that kind of quickness in one package, I mean, that's a freaky thing. And you put a freak in any sport like that and give them the right training, they're going to excel. And that's what he was. But those people, instead of respecting that, it was like he's still the pro wrestler now. He just beat Frank Mir, and they were.
Yeah.
And he was mad that they were mad, because it was like, I just beat the world champion. I beat him clean. He's been insulting me, calling me a moron, calling me all these things on television, and I beat him, and the people still booed him, and it was just like, okay, boo me, I love it, and they booed him more and booed him more, and somehow, that became this big federal thing. I mean, I'm going to jump on Sable. I thought that line was kind of funny. She was laughing, so, I mean, she certainly had no problem with it, but... it was it was just the right set of circumstance on the right show, and but you know what? I mean, Lesnar and Dana White, don't kid yourself. Aside from the sponsor comment, they are loving it. They're not.
Absolutely.
They're publicly apologizing. I can't tell you for a fact with Dana, because I haven't talked with him. I can tell you for a fact with Brock. Brock knows he did the right thing.
I was saying to a guy today who brought it up, I said, listen, in watching the lead-in show last week when Mir threw himself on the mat and said, this is not WWE or something, it pissed me off.
Which was Dean Albrecht's son, who was one of his partners.
Yeah, it pissed me off. And I said, that's what I said to this guy. I said, and when Lesnar came up after eating Mir's lunch, he was saying, hey, screw you, right? I am what I am. And I haven't read it, but I heard that Lance Storm had on his blog had mentioned, Brock is not representing us or our business. He's representing himself. And at some point, the purist in MMA, whether it be the athletes or some of the fans or the writers, have got to understand that. And after last Saturday night, if they can't take this guy serious, then they're deaf, dumb, and blind.
Well, but I think it's great that they don't, because they have created a situation where this guy is that moment when he won and in that building, I mean, I haven't seen anything like that in years. And it's funny because it's like, Les, you will understand this. And believe me, because I was fighting this fight that night. I don't know how to explain this, but I do know what it is from being around wrestling for, 38 years. All I could think of is, this is money. You know what I mean? It's like you're just there. You know the moment. And it's like, oh, my God. It's like when Terry Gordy slammed that door on Kerry Von Erich's head. I watched it on TV about 2 weeks later, but I wasn't in the building. But when I watched that thing on TV, I was going, oh, my God, this is money. And it was. And that was my feeling, being in that arena. And then there were people just going like, oh, it's, people aren't going to like this. They're not going to watch again because they don't like Brock Lesnar. And it's like, man, you don't understand what makes people, you know, fans of sports. You know, you need you need someone to root against as much as someone to root for, and he gave him someone to root against, and whomever his next opponent is an instant star just by facing him, and the next guy who beats him is going to be a superstar, you know, just like Ollie was when he beat Sonny Liston, you know, and it's created a dynamic that they've never had before.
Yeah, you're right.
You know, and it will be, they will, I don't know if they will do more business because this was a freaky thing with the UFC 100, but the next Brock Lesnar show will do the second highest buy rate in the history of that company. And then hopefully by then some people will understand that, in fact, this was money instead of like, oh, my God, now, you know, all the mainstream saw Brock and he's an uncouth ogre and now no one's ever going to watch the sport again. Yeah, it's not going to happen that way.
No, more the interruption today.
Pardon the interruption today. They were talking about it, and they even said, you know, this is the right thing for UFC. They've created this ultimate heel, and he's money for it.
And I mean, you know, the funniest thing of the whole thing is that promoters and bookers, and I mean in MMA as much as in pro wrestling, sit there and they try to calculate and do it, and it, like, you know, like with Steve Austin, I mean, it's like
it happens.
Nobody came up with a plan. I mean, Brock half-assed, yes, but it was a series of circumstances that nobody could plan. Dana White, 20 years from now, may very well take credit for it, but it was a series of circumstances, and you just lucked. You know, and it's just like with Vince McMahon in that you know, in the real history of that Monday Night Wars. You know, WCW's incompetence definitely did them in. But, you know, Steve Austin and The Rock, I mean, I know people who are high on The Rock, and I know what people thought of The Rock, but nobody crafted The Rock. The Rock got himself over. Nobody came up with this blueprint for, you know, this is how we're going to get The Rock over. No. The Rock thought, this is how I'm getting myself over, and he did. Austin, you know, however it is, this is the character I'm going to create, and he did it. And now, to their credit, they didn't bury them, but they didn't create them. They just gave them the platform, and that, you know. And
it was
and
the right chemistry
guys
at the right time in the right place.
The right guy at the right time, unless you've seen it. I mean, in territories, there's different guys, and it's like they may not have even been the guy who the promoter picked. You know, somebody else. I mean, I one of the things that an example, this is in 2005, when the whole company was going to build, you know, around Randy Orton, and then all of a sudden it ended up being Dave Bautista that the crowd liked. You know, as the baby face-to-face triple, that would be the new star. And you know, Batista didn't last in the role, but for that year, Dave Bautista was a big deal.
Right, exactly. Yeah,
well,
you're right.
Well,
Dave,
obviously, we want to definitely thank you for coming on with us tonight. I got Mike Mooneyham right up behind you, so we need to
wrap up
and move on to him. But, man, you know, thanks for giving us your time tonight, and look forward to this week's newsletter. I'm sure it's going to be pretty interesting with the USC coverage.
Yeah, okay, thanks very much.
All right, man.
David, always a pleasure. Take care.
Okay, hey, Les, thanks, and we'll talk soon.
All right, good.
Hopefully.
Yes.
All right, and we will be back with more Peach State Pandemonium in just a second. I'm going to go grab Mike Mooneyham, and we will be back in about 2 minutes.
while at work. Listen to it perk. Look at the coffee as it gets darker and stronger. Smell the honest coffee smell. Ah, smell it. But will this cup of coffee taste as good as it smells? You bet it will, because it's Maxwell House, the coffee that tastes as good as it smells every time. Maxwell House coffee tastes as good as it smells every time. If you like to look at good coffee, listen to good coffee, smell good coffee, and taste good coffee, brew Maxwell House, the coffee that tastes as good as it smells every time. Maxwell House is good to the last drop. It tastes as good as it smells every time. Maxwell House.
All right, back on Peach State Pandemonium, we've got Mike Mooneyham with us from the Charleston Post-Courier. Mike, how you doing tonight?
Doing great, thanks.
Mike Mooneyham, I remember when I was a little boy, I used to come to matches in Charleston.
Hey, Les.
How you doing, kiddo?
Good, man. Good. How are you?
Not too bad for an old guy. Hanging in there, you know.
You're not old.
Hey, go ahead, Les. Go ahead.
I was just going to say that we were discussing 25 years ago Black Saturday and how dreadful that must have been for the people in Atlanta and the surrounding areas, more so than those of, you know, those in the outlying areas who had just gotten heavy on the superstition. How did that feel for you?
Oh, it was terrible. I mean, you know, here we have great wrestling every week for. And, you know, Atlanta had run live TV. I mean, I think it was like, you know, by the time it got bought up by WWE, it had live wrestling for 50-something years. It was a shock. Here we have Freddie Miller coming on, and, you know, we're looking for live ring action. And then we have Vince McMahon and Gorilla Monsoon in a studio with clips from the old WWF, and it was... It was awful, and it didn't take long before the fans just had a major uproar and protest. Never seen anything like it. And, you know, I think the worst thing about it was no more Gordon Solie. You know, how could wrestling fans live without Gordon?
Yeah, it's okay. We had Tony Schiavone and David Crockett come to the rescue a few weeks later.
you did, but it's...
You know what, though? I've got to say this. You talk about versatility and people... You know, different taste. I've had people say that they thought David Crockett one of the greatest wrestling announcers of all time, and I'm not even going to comment on that. I'm just, we'll move on. Anyway, you know what I think is the one thing that I sit and think about and talk about Vince having a big set is to have taken the spot, that slot, on the, well, what, there was only one other big cable station, I guess that was Chicago at the time, who was national, and to tell the owners, the president, whatever, that we're going to do live just like everybody else, and then come on and do film clips. I mean, it's like kind of thumbing your nose, right?
And the same clips you could see on WOR in USA.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what really got Ted Turner, you know, upset. He was expecting some quality stuff, some in studios, you know, some wrestling at the studio, and Vince didn't deliver. And, you know, I think Vince mainly just wanted to take over those territories. I mean, it was a pretty lucrative area. You had Georgia, you had Michigan, you had Ohio, and, you know, that was part of his national expansion. And had he succeeded, we might not have had 16 more years of, you know, NWA-style CW. Vince could have ended it right there. But I think it was very important that the fans protested loudly about the switch, because otherwise, who knows, Vince might have been around for a lot longer, and, you know, there may have been no WCW.
Yeah, and of course, you know, it was, I know TBS was flooded with phone calls and, of course, letters and all this, that, and the other. And literally by, you know, the first week in August, I mean, actually within 2 weeks, they were taping matches down in Macon. Actually, I think it was a week later.
I think it was a week later. Yeah, Ole and Fred Ward started doing matches right out of Macon, and they forgot what the name of the show was, but it was like Georgia Wrestling 84.
Yeah, at first they actually just, instead of World Championship Wrestling, it was World Championship Wrestling 84.
Yeah,
and,
exactly. Yeah.
And at first it was just really on in Fred Ward's markets, and then eventually kind of worked its way a few weeks later up to Channel 46 here in Atlanta. And by August, of course, with Ann Gunkel's help, surprisingly.
Yes, very surprising.
You know, they end up on WTBS, but my God, who's getting up at 7:35 in the morning to watch wrestling?
Yeah, believe me, that was tough. It wasn't exactly prime time television.
Well, you know, I've shared the story before, but I'll throw it out there again.
Yeah.
I had just turned 16
yeah.
that March, and you know, I had followed wrestling since I was as far back as I can remember, actually farther than that, because I know my most vivid memories were many years after I started watching, but I had gotten my first job, and as a teenager, you're stuck with the bad shifts on the weekend. So here I am working, you know, swing shift on Saturday. So between, I think I started that job in like early April. So between April and July, I worked practically every Saturday, and I had a buddy of mine, you know, supposed to be taping them for me, and of course that worked for about 3 weeks, and
yeah.
then that was done.
Yeah.
And then here we go. My boss is finally cool, and he's like, hey, you know, you want a Saturday off? You've been working every Saturday for a few months. I'm like, oh, yeah, great, you know, I'd love to.
Right.
And of course, you know, here I am Saturday evening, got my bowl of popcorn ready to go, 6:05. Unfortunately, my first Saturday off was July the 14th, 1984.
Oh, no, are you serious?
Yeah. So, imagine my surprise. But, you know, by the time the Saturday morning show was on, I didn't even know about it until a few months later.
Yeah, well, you know, news traveled slowly back then, and I never really liked WWF wrestling to begin with. You know, I didn't like it that. I mean, it was okay, but the guys were slow and prodding, and I mean, it really attracted a whole different type of audience. As Les remembers, you know, Carolinas and Virginia were, I mean, it was premium stuff down here, as well as Georgia and the Florida circuit. And all of a sudden to have to watch these guys, you know, with tape matches, merely clips, not from the famous studio with the three cameras and Gordon Solie announcing. It was like, gee, how long are we going to have to put up with this? I mean, it was many people had grown up, well, like yourself, you know, you'd grown up with Georgia Championship Wrestling and Championship Wrestling from Georgia. And, I mean, it was more than just a wrestling show. It was appointment TV.
Well, you know, the fact that, you know, for so many years at the city auditorium, every Friday night, and,
mm-hmm.
and you know, by the time the city auditorium was shut down, it was, you know, they'd be at the Omni at least every 2 to 3 weeks.
Yep.
And of course, that was, I think that kind of contributed to part of the slowdown, but in attendance, but, you know, they actually went through a boom period. So in 81 and 82, it picked back up, even though they were kind of now back to 3 weeks and doing the Northern
yep.
tours.
Yep.
Of course, we all know they went through money troubles in 83, and
yep.
Barnett had been pretty much ousted and went to work with Vince and probably brokered the whole thing, or at least kind of set the wheels in motion. But, you know, all of a sudden you didn't have that anymore. And, you know, you could only count on the WWF to come here once a year. You know, even today, just watching today, I mean, Dave kind of touched on it, and I was going to elaborate on it, but we were kind of running low on time. But, you know, as he said, you can't get invested in what you're watching on TV enough to be that passionate to care about it when you go to see it live.
No, you can't. You really can't.
And you know, it's really hard to get pulled into it.
Are you saying that you didn't get excited about Seth Green being a six-man tag last night?
Oh, God, that was awful, wasn't it?
You know what? I watch it because I do this show, and because I write a column, and because for some stupid reason, I still have a passion and love for the business, which
yeah.
is, you know, but I'm watching this and I'm thinking, okay, so you've got a celebrity as a host. Why pray tell, does he have to be in the ring? And then I hear Lawler say, well, Seth Green is not only the star of Robot Chicken and whatever, whatever, but now he's a WWE superstar. And I'm thinking, yeah, that's exciting because now 15,000 kids will think, well, you know, I've had two matches. I must be ready to be a WWE superstar, too.
That, too.
You know, and next week, I'm a big ZZ Top fan, but are they going to wrestle the Cologne Brothers next week and do a job
for
them?
I don't know. Maybe he's going to go in there and throw John Cena around or something. To me, I hate that when a celebrity makes contact with a professional wrestler, you automatically diminish the influence of the wrestler. It's the celebrity that actually gets a rub as far as wrestling is concerned. And how do you take these guys seriously when they attempt to take a bump from one of these celebrities or even athletes from another sport? I know why they do it. They do it to gain new viewers, but I mean, I can't think that somebody who just watches these guys on TV are actually going to become wrestling fans because they saw Seth Green on a wrestling show.
And you know, I'm going to say this: in Knoxville, we had some. The guy who was the host on Wild Kingdom, the younger of the two guys, and I can't think of his name.
Yeah, I know you're talking about.
Huh?
Yeah, I know who you're talking about.
Yeah, okay. Well, he lived west of Knoxville, and I had him in and did a personality profile with him one weekend, and we put over what he did, you know, and I put over the fact, you know, hey, I've wrestled some big guys, but I wouldn't wrestle alligators and snakes like you do, you know, that sort of thing. But at no time ever did we consider letting him hit a wrestler, get in the ring, or even getting physically involved in any way, shape, or form. It just, we had... on another channel in Knoxville, there was a guy who did hosted old Western movies and dressed up like a cowboy. Had him do a thing one time, and it was kind of shtick with Kevin Sullivan. But in no way, shape, or form was there ever, you know, we never even discussed throwing a punch or, you know, I mean, it was done comedy because it was comedy, you know.
Sure.
It wasn't like, well, Kevin, I'm going to get nose to nose with you, because in that case, I would have said, Kevin, knock him on his ass.
Yeah.
You know, because that's what you do. Well, you know, Cornette, when Jimmy used to run the smaller towns when he had Smoky Mountain, it wasn't uncommon for him to go in with a local DJ or the college or the high school football coach or somebody and do an arm wrestling. But it was Jimmy, the manager.
Yeah.
It was never one of the wrestlers.
No, it was the Mama Cornette spoiled kid. It wasn't somebody who actually was a wrestler. And that's the problem I have with wrestling today. I mean, and even TNA does it, you know, bringing these guys in and just for name value only. And they really should not be in a wrestling ring, and I just hate it. I hate it. I hate it.
Me too.
But, this is a new era of wrestling. It's an entirely different business today.
And it's, you know what, Mike, and it's not wrestling. As it's diluted, the product's diluted, and you know, I don't know if it's just me, but like watching SmackDown last Friday, Kid Ziggler, and then Crime Time, and even with the new Hart Dynasty thing, it's obvious that these kids don't have any experience. They need a veteran to lead them to make the match flow and get the small things in. It's obvious that they have sat in the dressing room and choreographed this damn thing, and they're just going through the motions. And you can't get emotionally involved with robots. I mean, you know, you just can't. I mean, it's the same old, same old. It's like, well, Cena and Helmsley, they don't get along, so we're going to make them a team. Well, you just did that with Punk and Hardy on Friday night. And... like when everybody was saying, you know, what a great host DiBiase was, and I'm not saying that Teddy wasn't a great host, but when he said, well, to Orton, you're going to have to defend your title in a three-way, nobody cares. They do three ways every week. You know, I mean, there's nothing that's fresh. You know, and then Friday night, Punk was in with Kali, which, you know, it was Punk. With a big guy, and I'm thinking, this is your champion. You're putting him with a slug who can't work a lick, And Punk, bless his heart, I like CM's a personal friend. He worked for me when he was a kid, but he can't carry Kali either, and it does nothing for him as champion. And then on Monday night, I see Big Show throwing Evan Bourne all over the friggin' place, and I'm thinking, why? What is the value in that? You know,
there is no value, Les. There's no value in any of that, and I think the writing is horrific. I don't think they're writing for a wrestling audience at all, and I don't even know what audience they are writing for, because it's not good writing. And all of these things you touched upon, they're very true, and they're not helping that company one bit. I really, you know, I've got to cover all of this. I still have to, and I have a hard time watching those many hours of wrestling every week. I mean, it's almost like a chore when it used to be, I can't wait to see this show. What are they going to do? I mean, one week it's a three-way, one week it's a four-way. You know, we have these guests. I don't even like the concept of general manager every week.
No.
I don't like the concept of having a guy, be it a wrestler or an official, you know, laying out the whole show in advance and saying, you're going to be in a three-way and you're going to be in a three-on-one handicap match. I don't
like, you know, and then having Chavo do a job for Hornswoggle on his knees. I mean, there's no possible way you can invest anything, any type of serious, you can't suspend your disbelief in something stupid like that.
No, and you're right. There is no emotional investment. And if you don't have that in a show, be it a wrestling show or The Young and the Restless, a soap opera. If you can't do that, how successful can that show be?
Yeah, let me ask you guys a question. You mentioned TNA earlier, and I'm going to.
Yeah.
Did either one of you watch Damages on the FX with Glenn Close? Great. It was great. It's been two seasons. I don't know if they're coming back for a third season or not. Mm-hmm. But anyway, it was well written. But anyway. One of the great political lines of the last century is I read that in an interview Kevin Nash done that he said that he's always believed in Vince Russo, and Russo's writing was so great that you couldn't talk on the phone you had to pay attention to Russo's writing, and it was like Damages on FX, and I'm thinking, Kevin, what are you smoking, and where can I get a pound? I mean,
the same guy who's writing that stuff now.
No, I never talk on the phone when I watch Russo's angles, and all I get is upset. Right? I can't figure him out even when I'm trying to figure him out.
I don't want my mind to work overtime when I'm watching a wrestling show.
Well, and that's the problem these days is literally if you watch 2 hours of TNA, you feel like you've just watched 6 hours because you had that much to soak in. Let me corral this thing back around. Mike, one thing I wanted to ask you when we had you on was you, of course, being from Crockett Land, with Crockett being the one guy who basically probably had the best shot, at least because he had the TBS slot at the time and started trying to compete with Vince, could he have done it? Could he have been more successful did he even have a shot, really? Was it just the fact that Dusty was booking and killing him? Or, you know, what would you have done differently? Was there maybe somebody else you felt like could have maybe competed with Vince a little better, maybe put out a better product that might have lasted?
Well, you know, I love Bill Watts' product. It was very regional, but Bill knew how to put on great episodic television.
Mm-hmm.
His Mid-South shows and the UWF were, you know, I would match them up against any show, wrestling shows ever. They were great. I just don't think Bill had the financial resources to compete at a level. You know, Vince was well on his way, especially after the first couple of WrestleManias. I think the wheels had already been set in motion. Vince was paying these guys a lot of money. He was raiding the territories. You know, I think Crockett could perhaps have lasted longer had he not had Dusty as a booker at the end. Crockett spent entirely too much money that he could have used to make this battle go a little bit longer. But, you know, I think it was Vince's game to win. And like I said, had there not been such a revolt against him in Georgia back in 84, who knows what might have happened. It could have changed the whole face of the wrestling business.
Right. And you know, Dave kind of mentioned it earlier tonight when he basically said, you know, Vince was a genius or is a genius. And you know, quite honestly, whether or not he was the first person to take a shot or had somebody else maybe done it and then he came back in, I still think he would have ultimately won out.
Yeah, and he was on an entirely different path. Georgia, the NWA, they, you know, had great wrestling, and you know, they certainly had the advantage of that. But Vince had a vision, and a lot of it was in merchandising. Even with the lousy shows they were playing in Atlanta back in '84, he still had that eye that, you know, we're gonna make wrestling more entertainment, more of a Saturday morning cartoon than actual wrestling, and that's actually when he, you know, started peddling merchandising, and I mean, of course, it was going to explode in the next couple of years, but he had a vision, and I think it was one that everyone else was, you know, were too geared into the old professional wrestling concept, and I think times have changed. I think, you know, Vince knew this. He had been in the business, you know, third generation promoter, and I think it was his game to win all along.
Right. Hey, you know I noticed. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I was going to say what Mike was saying, that some of the things that Jimmy could have done differently, and where some of the money was spent. I remember when they started traveling with the Bash and Waylon Jennings and
David Allen Coe,
they did that at the ballpark here in Cincinnati, and it didn't draw anything because that was a regional thing, and it wasn't it wasn't going to be a big seller in Cincinnati. I could have told somebody that if they'd asked, you know, but you know, that's something that's going to sell in Mobile, you know, or Nashville, but it's sure not going to sell everywhere. And there was a lot of money spent on things like that that helped drive the nail in the coffin, too, I think.
Yeah, private jets, you know, that lavish Dallas office that they opened.
Yeah.
They didn't need to spend all of that money.
Well, you know, he was going to open a third TV production unit, and the reason I know that for a fact is I had moved back up here in 85, you know, back to Cincinnati. And Jimmy called me, and he said, I'm going to start a third television production unit, and would you be interested in heading it up? And I said, yeah, I sure would. And we talked for a while, and of course, it never materialized because, you know, the whole business went south for him at that time. But he was going to base that out of Nashville, as I recall.
Wow.
Wow, okay. Interesting. Hey, I noticed we got some callers on the line. One more question for you guys, and then we'll see what callers have got to say.
Okay.
And by the way, we do still have some open lines. If you got something to call in about, please call in, share your GCW memories, or complain about whatever with Black Saturday. What are your thoughts? The question to you guys, obviously the guys are making a ton of money today in comparison to what they were doing back then. You know, we've already kind of covered earlier tonight with Dave that, you know, there were clearly more fans watching back then, even though there's more money to be made today. Is the business, I mean, obviously the business is better for the boys today, right?
For a much smaller percentage of the boys.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, there's not as many guys working and able to make a living today. Not near.
Yeah, we had 30-something territories, strong territories back in the day. You know, now we've got one major company in TNA and a bunch of independents.
Right. Tell you what, let's go ahead and you want to stick around and take some calls with us? And
sure, I'd love
continue
to.
Continue to chat? Okay. All right. Calling from Atlanta, the 770s area code. You're on the line.
I guess that would be me, Bob Allen.
All right. Hey, Bob, how are you?
Hey, Bob.
Hey, again. Hi, Rich. Hi, Les. Hi, Mike.
All
hey,
right.
Hey.
For those who don't know, Bob Allen, of course, Gordon Soley's son-in-law.
Hello, Bob Allen.
Been about 4 years, Mr. Thatcher.
Yeah, it's been a while, hasn't it?
Tampa Wrestling Reunion. And I saw
Rich last year
at the NWA, 60th anniversary show?
Yep, last summer.
I haven't
got
talked
for
to Mike.
Tonight,
Well, the evening is Black Saturday, and I just want to tell you that not too long after that occasion, I had the pleasure to sit down with Gordon Solie in his living room and just listen to how pissed off he was at life. The man was hot, okay?
Well, give us an exclusive. Share some of that with us.
Well, you have to read the new book here in a little while to get the rest of it. But Gordon had a nice offer from McMahon's company, and they even wanted him to they talked about maybe hosting with Gene Okerlund. But Gordon said them they wanted him to wear tuxedo. Anyone going to wear any GD tuxedo?
I remember something about that, Bob. It was he was very upset about that.
You know, well, it was the number one television wrestling show in the world, and then it was gone, you know?
You know, the funny thing that you say that, Bob, and Gordon and I mean, we shared a lot of things, but we never. But when I flew to Stanford in 85 and talked to them about coming on board, I was asked what I didn't like about the business. And one of the things I said, I didn't like wearing a tux because that made me think of Humphrey Bogart 1940s fight movie. And I thought we had progressed past that. But, yeah, I can hear Gordy saying that. Yes, absolutely.
That wasn't his real reason, obviously, because he still had loyalties to the territories. That's what he grew up with.
Right.
And he was sorry to see that end because it was a lifestyle. Even people that couldn't get to the show in Atlanta, if they were having a live show, they could certainly get together with their whole neighborhood and have a barbecue and drink some beer and watch. At 6:05 Saturday night, they watched Gordon Sully and the wrestlers. And when
the highlight of my Saturday was watching Gordon come on. I mean, you know, when you see this emblem displayed, you are assured of the optimum in professional wrestling. And sure enough, very quickly, someone like Ric Flair, you know, Ole Anderson would come out, and the show was off to a roaring start. But can you imagine Freddie Miller opening the show with, you know, Vince McMahon and Gorilla Monsoon, who, you know, a lot of casual fans back then, they didn't even know who these guys were.
You know, I can't even begin to put a value on what Gordon meant to me. I mean, my God, just, you know, my vocabulary increased tenfold just listening to him.
Yeah, absolutely.
He sat there in his living. He sat in the living room, and he had a vodka in one hand, and he had a cigarette in the other one, and he pointed at me with the cigarette and said, "This guy McMahon, now you watch. He's poised to make the biggest impact on professional wrestling of anybody around." And that was in the summer of 84. So he knew he would not be surprised at all that Vince McMahon in the end triumphed because he knew what he was doing.
Yeah, well, he must have envisioned Vince McMahon coming on board for the opposition at some point. I mean, Eric Bischoff, excuse me.
That's not a good subject with Gordon Solie to bring up either.
I'm sorry about that, Bob.
Oh, sore spot night, so I'll expect the Black Saturday. But, no, Gordon kept some letters that the fans wrote in, and they're not nice. No, they start out like, "McMahon, you stinking little worm." I mean, these people were hot.
Oh, they were. There were articles written in the Atlanta Constitution. I mean, it was big news back then.
Oh, yeah, yeah. But the way they flooded, I mean, Gordon already said, you know, he thought professional wrestling was a healthy catharsis because people worked hard all week, then they go to the matches, and they could vent there, and boy, they could vent. But they're different than other fans who might, you know, be upset. They'll write to the station. They'll get on the phone and call them. And he would said that stuff before that ever happened.
Yeah.
That Monday morning when WTBS, you know, opened for business, they were in for a surprise.
Sure.
But and the letters were incredible, and they're nasty, you know.
Yeah,
so,
well, they were taking away one of the fans' biggest deals, and that was Georgia Championship Wrestling. And when Freddie Miller said, "Be there," you didn't want to be there anymore.
Well, they happened in Florida, too, when Gordon got upset with Crockett and quit.
Yep.
The show was only championship wrestling from Florida, and it lasted a couple more months, I think. But Tom McEwen said that, you know, Tampa Tribune, their phone lines were and their complaints went on for weeks after Gordon because they didn't see Gordon on TV.
I'm sure.
Yeah, I remember when I was doing a radio show up here, and we did a tribute to Gordon. I had Thez and Don Curtis and Dory Funk and Brad Armstrong. I forget, you know, call in and
heard it.
I've got it on tape somewhere, but I don't know where right now. But anyway, yeah. I remember talking, you know, and part of that, him walking out then, was due to that Hall of Fame thing, too.
Yeah.
I can't remember the exact details, but Bob may. But that's probably in the book, right, Bob?
Yes, you're talking WCW was the Hall of Fame show, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, but he was upset with something had happened there because he was supposed to have a hand in making a decision on who got in inducted.
He had for a couple of years. They listened to him in
93
and 94. They took some of his suggestions for nominees for the Hall of Fame, for WCW Hall of Fame.
Right.
And then he got a phone call asking if he'd done his research. He didn't even know who they were, who the candidates were, so he was upset that he wasn't consulted. He just didn't like the way things were going anyway, and then he said, I'm not coming. I'm not going to the 95 Hall of Fame ceremony. And so then Bischoff called him on the phone later, and he fired Gordon on the phone because Gordon got into it with him. And then I think Gary Juster called back and smoothed over by telling Gordon that you're going to be inducted. So Gordon decided, he said his ego got the better of him because that's when he decided to go back and go ahead and do the show, because he usually announced the guys, too, who were ever getting inducted.
Right.
But shortly after the ceremony, though, Gordon tendered his resignation.
Rich, are you still there?
Yeah, I'm listening to you guys.
Okay.
Letting you go.
you went a long way from Black Saturday.
No, that's cool. You know, Gordon Sully was as much a part of Georgia Championship Wrestling as anybody. Of course, we talk about the fact that it ended 30 years of wrestling and at least televised in the Atlanta market. And, before Gordon was Ed Caprell, and, I would imagine you guys have some fond memories of him as well.
Yeah, very much so. I loved the Atlanta wrestling show back then. I guess it was at WTCG, is that correct?
When he was on, they were on Channel 11, which
Channel
11, changed call
yeah.
letters over various years.
Right.
But, yeah.
Right. I used to actually pick up the show here in Charleston. I loved getting any TV wrestling show I could. And back then, and we're talking about, back in the 60s and 70s.
Right.
I got an antenna, to maybe sometime on Saturday. I think we got it at the Savannah station. Got it on Saturday nights at like 11 p.m. So I put up an antenna. Then I got a rotor, and every Saturday night at 11, I would position that antenna just right so I could pick up championship wrestling. I think they called it big time wrestling. And Ed Caprell was great. He was a wonderful announcer, kind of like our Bob Caudle down here, and just a wonderful guy.
Yeah, that sounds your setup system there sounds similar to when I would take trips up to North Georgia to see my great grandmother and spend time with her. And if I was there on the weekends, man, I was pulling up Mid Atlantic wrestling. So.
It was big stuff back then.
Oh, absolutely. Well, before cable, all you got before and before syndication too. I mean, all you really got outside of your own market was whatever you read in the magazines. And to me, that used to be the most fun was tuning into Channel 17 each Saturday, waiting to see some new guy that you read about in the magazines. Never had a chance to see him, and all of a sudden he's in your area. That was always great fun to me.
Well, in the 70s, Championship Wrestling from Florida wasn't in big syndication, but it was out there because I know when Danny Miller and I came into back into Charlotte in 71 as a team, we were both surprised that a lot of places. People were well. I'd been in the territory. Danny had never been in the territory before. Of course, I'd been there, but they were familiar with the both of us simply off the Florida thing.
Right.
That's right.
And of course, Florida TV aired here. It was when Barnett and Gunkel struck their deal to basically end all South. that TV slot first went to Florida. And, you know, they were bringing tapes up here to show them on Channel 17, and then eventually, not sure what happened in that, but that's when Georgia Championship Wrestling took over and became a two-hour program. Or I should say two one-hour programs, because that's essentially what they were doing at the time.
Rich, I think we were very hardcore fans.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. You talk about watching the business today and how hard it is to watch so many hours of this programming. I'm sure every now and then you're kicking yourself for not sticking in those Mid-Atlantic tapes.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the little speech I made up in Iowa this weekend at the Hall of Fame Museum, I said, you know, from the very first time I turned on an old black and white television set, and I was an avid sports fan. I was just a kid, you know, nine years old, and turned the TV on, and I saw a 601-pound man in overalls and wearing a horseshoe teaming up with this good-looking young guy named Johnny Weaver against this pair of what appeared to be foreign menaces named Aldo Bogni from Buenos Aires, Argentina, and his partner Bronco Lubitsch from Belgrade, Yugoslavia, with this scowling, hickory cane-wielding manager named Colonel Homer Odell, who later became General Homer Odell. I mean, I was hooked. You know, this opened up a new world for me. I said, you know, I've got to see more of this. And from then on, I was, you know, I couldn't get out of my system. But now, like Les alluded to, you kind of watch it because you're in a position where you have to.
Right, right.
If you were a kid today, would you actually, you know, be a fan? Certainly you wouldn't have, I don't think you would have the passion that the guys like us did so many years ago.
Yeah, you know, we were talking, Mike Sempervivi hosts our co-host the Friday night show on our network with me,
mm-hmm.
and Ringside Rap, cheap plug. You know, we were talking about that and just talking about the frustration we feel, you know, having to watch this stuff and talk about it. And, you know, yeah, there's good moments, but, God, it seems like there's so many more bad moments and just moments where you're just pulling your hair out, you know, trying to figure out a way to enjoy this stuff. And I threw it out there a couple of weeks ago. I said, you know, it's gotten a lot less frustrating for me since I finally came to the realization while watching one night and said, you know what? It is not what I grew up on. It is not intended to be what I grew up on. So take it for what it is, and maybe you won't hate it so much. And,
but you
and
know what?
It has become somewhat less frustrating.
you know what drives
me? Because it's like comparing
me.
Apples to oranges.
Yeah, I'll tell you what drives me crazy is talk shows, writers, or if I listen to something on the Internet, they're saying, well, for what it wasn't bad, but because you're satisfied with it. Because that's all there is.
The bar
has
been lowered, Les.
Huh?
The bar has been lowered.
Yeah.
Well, it certainly has. Very, very low, as a matter of fact. Yeah. Well, you know, it has. And that's going to, I mean, it's going to affect it when all of, well, Rich will still be around because he's a young kid and Bob may be.
Mm-hmm.
But Mike, you and I will be gone by the time the workers don't know how to work at all. I mean,
away now, Les.
No, I know. That's what I'm saying. You know, we may still be around for that, too. But, it's a bad product. And it's not, you know, here's the shame of it, too. There's so many guys from my generation.
Yeah.
And some of them former big stars that will not watch the product for any reason. And, this, you know, and somebody will say, well, what's it about? I said, well, stop and think about it. Stan Musial still watches baseball. You know, Oscar Robertson still watches basketball. You know, the pro football, you know, Bart Starr, whoever's still alive that played football back in the Lombardi era, still watches football.
Sure.
But that the guys who paved the way for these people to make a living are so turned off that they don't watch it anymore, I think that's very sad.
That's right. Everyone I talked to Rip Hawk a couple of days ago, and Rip doesn't watch wrestling anymore.
Jack Briscoe won't watch it anymore.
Yeah, and that says a lot.
Yeah.
Well, Bob, let me ask you, do you guys actually watch any of the current product?
Not much. I will check into TNA once in a while just because, you know, I know I've met some of those guys. It means more when you know them.
Right.
And I kept in touch with Mike Tenay over the years, and he's always been just a sweetheart of a guy, and he loved Gordon. so probably more from that aspect, I'll tune in to listen to him. And once in a great while on a Friday, I might turn on just because I want to hear Jim Ross, you know. But
yeah.
It's not because of the product. It's just because there's a couple guys I've met in person or I've kept in contact with, and I want to hear them, you know. So it's different than before. Before, I liked to hear Gordon, he was announcing, but the product along with it was had me more hooked than today. I could take it or leave it, you know.
Yeah, right. Well, hey, you know, we're down under 10 minutes. Let me ask you real quick, Bob. Obviously, the new book on Gordon is coming out. Kind of give us some details on that.
Well, this is actually his biography before we published his short stories and writings, but this goes into his childhood in depth and his early career in stock car racing, radio, the whole thing, and the different wrestling promotions, his likening of the spirits, you might say. There's a lot of good drinking stories in there about Gordon from the guys.
That'd be worth the price alone, I'm sure.
And probably have a timetable in about 2 weeks. Scott will be announcing it because Scott Teal from Crowbar Press is doing this one for us.
Yep.
And he's been a big help. And so there's been basically four of us, myself, my wife, Scott, and then Michael Kenyon has thrown in a few, chimed in a few things here and there. So I'm very happy with it, actually. It's the last 7 months, that's pretty much what they did 6 days a week from morning, noon, and night to get it finished. So I think Scott will make some kind of announcement within about 2 weeks. He'll know a date that we'll have it in our hands.
Very good.
So we're excited. And I'm excited to be on with you guys. It's cool to talk to you.
Oh, yeah. Good to have you. It's been I think since the last time we had you on the show, almost a year ago.
It's been a while.
Bob, please give the wife my best too.
I will. She still loves you, Les.
Well, good. Thank God.
Best of luck with your book, Bob.
Thank you much, and appreciate talking to all of you. And I'm going to check out now and let you guys wrap things up. So, good evening.
Okay, Bob.
Bye,
thanks,
Bob.
Thanks
take care, Bob.
All right, so basically what we know is what we used to watch was apples, and what we're watching now is oranges. And 25 years ago, at least for the Atlanta market, and according to Dave Meltzer, people outside the Atlanta market, I guess, were affected too. And so, you know, I guess at the end of the day, maybe we aren't making it too big. If nothing else, I would say, and you guys tell me if I'm wrong, but I would say it was not the nail in the coffin by any chance, by any means, but at the very least, it, I don't know, maybe started the ignition?
Yeah.
I think it was the end of an era, for sure.
Yeah, I think so, too.
The beginning of the end.
Go ahead.
Go ahead, Les.
I agree with Meltzer. I mean, Vince is a genius. There's no two ways about it, but the product didn't need to be changed. And the crazy thing now is at every level, virtually everybody's trying to reinvent the wheel, and the wheel never needed to be reinvented to start with. There's no reason that you can't paint it another color. There's no reason that you can't dress it up a little differently, change the lapels on the jacket, or the take the bell bottoms away and make them straight legs, or put cuffs on the pants or whatever. But the foundation should still be the same, and yet, you know, they screw with that too, and I don't see the value.
Agreed. Yeah, I agree, 100% less. I don't like cliches too much, but I kind of like this one because it kind of sums everything up. It is what it is.
Yeah. Les, let me ask you, because I mean you were still in the business and at that time you'd been in the business 24 years, and somehow yet you're only 21.
Yeah.
You say that word got around and this, that, and the other, and guys knew, but really it was just another territory that was shutting down or whatever. But you slowly began seeing territory shut down and your friends getting less and less work. Just kind of real quick, I mean, sum up, what was it like to see these guys all of a sudden being basically put out of work?
It was tough. I mean, it really was. It's, well, like Mike mentioned earlier, you had 30 territories to choose And you could always, I mean, you know, if you wore out your welcome in one place, you picked up the phone and you called around till you found another spot, you know, to make a move. Everybody, there was a lot of guys working, and as Meltzer mentioned earlier, you know, they were a bigger audience television-wise. The numbers were bigger. I mean, now not on a national level, obviously, because there wasn't anything national. But guys who had made their living at the business, you know, couldn't make their living at it any longer. And it wasn't just old guys necessarily, but you know, and a lot of, you know, there were guys. And since corporate America has taken, well, part of corporate America is the reason our economy is in the problem it is now. But you know, there were guys who kept the dressing rooms loose and were funny and entertaining, couldn't even get work now because they didn't fit the corporate mold, you know. Right. But yet they, I mean, our business was full of characters, but all the characters weren't on camera, you know. A lot of it was just the characters in the dressing room. And it was, well, you know, you know, when guys from my generation talk about it, you had to have been there, you know. The camaraderie, the things we shared without even talking about what we shared, just knew that, you know, no one else had lived that lifestyle. You could live next door to the same people for 30 years, but if you weren't in the business, they could not understand what you did or why you did it or that whole situation. And that has changed so much, too. And when I say that, one of the most graphic examples of that is that I was told this story, it's been several months, well, last year I think it was, is that when Ricky Steamboat was helping put together a match, a tag match for four guys in WWE a couple years ago, he said, well, you know, here's something we did when I was working, and this worked out really well. You guys kicking around, and I'll be back a little bit, and we'll wrap this up. And he walked off, and one of these guys said to the other guys, looked at him with a blank stare on his face, and said, "Did Ricky used to work?"
Oh my God! Oh God!
And I thought somebody should have kicked him between his legs right then. I mean, he should have been castrated right there on the spot. I mean, come on, you know. And that's to say, there are guys in our business that don't even understand why they're in our business, because they have a good haircut or they make funny faces or, you know, it's not the same. And does that make me antiquated? If it does, I'm happy to be antiquated. Thank you very much. Because again, the wheel doesn't need to be reinvented. It can be painted a different color and have trinkets added, but it doesn't need to be reinvented. There's a lot of things that would draw people back if they just, and yet there will be people in these two major corporations saying, business is off. I wonder why.
Hey, Mike, did you have a story there you were trying to get?
Oh, well, I was just, when Les was talking about the guy, you know, in the Steamboat story.
Right.
I'm sure both of you probably heard about the time Lou Thesz was mentioned in the dressing room, and Lex Luger asked, "Who was Lou Thesz?"
Oh, Jesus, yeah.
It's totally unbelievable.
I've told the story before, but I do so many shows now, I can't remember which one I'm on, so I'll throw this one back out there because it fits. But there was a local wrestler here just a few years ago when Jody was just getting Deep South going with WWE, and this guy was actually, you know, he was being booked in pretty much every promotion around here and getting a nice push.
Yeah.
You know, kid had some talent, and yet he shows up to the first Deep South show sitting in the audience, and he goes, "Yeah, who's Joe Hamilton?" Oh, man. So, you know,
sure.
They're all over the place. All right, we're down to about 40 seconds left. Guys, got any last thoughts here?
Mike, it's always a pleasure to talk to you, my friend. Hope to get a chance to hook up with you and sit down and chat again soon.
Absolutely, Les. I was going through a few photos a few days ago, and I saw a photo from 1967 or 68, Les, that I took. You're wearing a green shamrock jacket. Do you remember that one?
Oh, yes. Probably still hanging in a closet somewhere.
All right. Well, Mike Mooneyham, we want to thank you. We also want to thank Dave Meltzer for joining us this evening, as well as Bob Allen. And this was our Black Saturday special. Hope you enjoyed it. Les and I will be back next Wednesday night. And tomorrow night, Shot in the Dark with Jimmy Rave and Sal Rinaro will be there, and they will return to their normal Tuesday next week. So we'll see you again here next week.
We thank you for listening to this broadcast brought to you by the GWH Radio Network. Be sure to stay tuned to GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com for information on upcoming shows, as well as all the news and information you could ever need and want. As always, GWH thanks you for your continued support.